Thank you, Scott, for leading us in those songs. Let me invite all of you to open again to the passage we began with in 2 Corinthians chapter 1. We're reading a lot in the paper these days and hearing on the news about our need for greater civility as a nation. Well, this morning we're going to look at a text. It's a transition text here in Corinthians between chapter 1 and chapter 2. In which Paul shares his feelings. He wants to treat the Corinthian brethren with civility, but even more, he wants to avoid hurting them. Paul here models sensitivity, and that's always a prelude to civility. There are a few passages in the New Testament where Paul wears his heart on his sleeve to the extent that he does here in these few verses. Read again with me, beginning in chapter 1, verse 23. I call God as my witness that it was in order to spare you that I did not return to Corinth. Not that we lord it over your faith, but we work with you for your joy. Because it is by faith you stand firm. So I made up my mind that I would not make another painful visit to you. For if I grieve you, who is left to make me glad but you whom I have grieved? I wrote as I did so that when I came I should not be distressed by those who ought to make me rejoice. I had confidence in all of you. That you would all share my joy, for I wrote you out of great distress and anguish of heart, and with many tears, not to grieve you, but to let you know the depth of my love for you. Paul had written two letters previously to this church. One of those letters we have, it's what we call 1 Corinthians. And he had to deal with them in a way that we would describe today as tough love. He had to lay it on the line, and he had to correct things that were wrong. And we all know how hard it is when we've got to go and confront someone. We dread having to do it. We're fearful that it may not go well, and Paul had all those fears. He wrote that letter. He had to make a subsequent visit to that church, a visit that he referred to as a painful visit. They had to sort things out. He had to shell the corn with that church, and it was a hard thing to do, and Paul hated doing that, and so he does not want to go again and have to do that. He says, in fact, I avoided making another visit because I shed tears over you, I love you, I don't want to hurt you, and he tried to deal with them in as sensitive a way as he possibly could. We've all had people deal with us in insensitive ways. We know what that feels like. All three of our girls were born in a Catholic hospital in Ireland, and we received wonderful care, and the greatest part of it all is that each of our girls cost us about $100, doctor bill, everything. You know, that was just amazing. They were born there, but we had one nurse who was on the side of insensitive. Our oldest daughter was born Breech. Now, in America, they don't typically let women go through those births like that, but in Ireland, they do. Kelly was born Breech. It was a distressed birth. The nurse came to us. They whisk her away, and we ask, is everything all right? Here we were, first-time parents. We were far away from family and close friends, and we were a little scared. And the nurse said, well, your child has infant respiratory syndrome. And we said, what's that? And she just sort of frowned and shook her head. And I said, is it fatal? And she said, not always. We began to pray immediately, and she noticed our concern, and she said, don't be worried. She said, there's a priest on duty, and he'll be able to administer last rites if needed. That's what we were left with. Well, fortunately, Kelly was healthy. She came through it, and our prayers were heard and answered, so we didn't have to worry after all. But you've dealt with people who didn't have a great bedside manner or who dealt with you in a way that was not very sensitive. Now, I want us to look here at Paul's example of dealing with a touchy situation. He had dealt with the church and had to correct that church, had to make a painful visit to that church. His history with them was not the greatest. There was a lot of room for misunderstanding and hurt and pain. And so Paul writes them, and he has these tender words. And he foregoes a second trip, and he expresses his love to them in a beautiful way. And what I want us to do this morning, I want you, every one of you, to take a sensitivity test. I'm going to ask you four questions, and we're going to look at how Paul dealt in these four areas as an example. And I just want you to rate yourself. We're not going to score it. Give yourself an A or give yourself an F. I hope you don't do that. But score yourself, and at the end of the sermon, see how you do in this area of sensitivity. Now, the Carnegie Institute says that our success in life is determined by two things. It's determined by our ability, and it's determined by our personality. And then they go on to rank which of these two qualities is most important to success, ability or personality. They say it breaks down like this. To be a success in life, it requires about 15% ability and about 85% personality. We all know people who have had the brains but simply could not relate to other people. Intelligence is no substitute for good relationship skills. Those who truly impact our lives and who influence in lives are those that we can identify with, and those who motivate us and encourage us, and those who relate to us. So this is critically important. And I want to just emphasize the importance of doing this. We're not talking about being sensitive this morning just so that you guys will get in touch with your feminine side. We're not talking about this just so you'll win friends and influence people. The importance in all of this is that you and I as Christians are God's ambassadors. We are His ambassadors to a lost world. And if we treat people rudely or caustically, then we will forever lose a hearing from those who desperately need to hear the message that you and I have about Jesus Christ. So it's imperative that we as God's people treat people with sensitivity and with kindness and with compassion and with understanding. So the first question in the four-question test is simply this. Are you perceptive about other people's feelings? Or are you the kind of person that just runs roughshod over people and their feelings? Look at Paul in chapter 1, verse 23. He says, I call God as my witness that it was in order to spare you that I did not return to Corinth. He canceled his trip. He said, I want to spare you any more hurt than you've already had at my hand. He said, I've already made one painful visit. I've already written you a hard letter. I'm not going to do this again because I want to spare you and your feelings. He was sensitive to what was going on in Corinth. He had prayed for that church. He longed for things to go well in that church. You've all seen people who are very sensitive to others and who pick up on little signals and know. And I've seen people do this in the most beautiful ways. When something is said that may be a little harsh and someone has the potential of having their feelings hurt, I've seen sensitive people just reach over and take someone's hand and give it a little squeeze just to let them know, I understand and I'm with you in that. Or I've seen people, when things are said that have the potential of hurting feelings, I've seen some sensitive soul look across the room and just give them a wink to let them know that they understand and that they're with them in spirit in whatever struggle they're having. You know, that's what's so wonderful about Jesus. Jesus understands. He is so sensitive to where we are. In Hebrews 4:15, we're told we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize. No, he does know. He does sympathize. He does understand where we are. So rate yourself in this area. How perceptive are you about other people's feelings? Are you aware of this? Do you respond to this in others? The second question I would ask you is this. When in a position of leadership, how do you treat your subordinates? Now, Paul had apostolic authority behind him. He had to defend that apostolic authority, but the one thing he refused to do was to use it like a club and beat them about the head with that authority. He could have thrown his weight around, but look what he wrote to them in verse 24. He says, "Not that we lord it over your faith, but we work with you for your joy, because it is by faith you stand firm." Paul wrote to the Thessalonian church in 1 Thessalonians 2:6, and he said, "As apostles, we could have been a burden to you, but we were gentle among you, like a mother caring for her little children." Yeah, we could have insisted on some things. We could have knocked a few heads, but we dealt with you in as gentle a method as a mother does with a little child. Peter wrote to his fellow elders and encouraged them not to lord it over the flock, but to be examples to the brethren. And let me say this, it's not just elders who have to deal with this temptation of lording it over or abusing positions of leadership or power, because leadership occurs at all levels within a congregation. Deacons have certain leadership responsibilities. Teachers have leadership responsibilities. Ministry leaders have responsibilities. So anyone who works as a leader in any area often has to direct others or request things of others or help, you know, guide others in various ways. So leadership can occur at all levels. And my question for you is, when you're in a position of leadership, when you do have influence over another, how do you treat those people that you're trying to lead or to guide or to superintend? I saw a cartoon about an education minister who had gone to the hospital to visit one of his Sunday school teachers, and he shows him walking in the room, and there that person is, both legs are in traction and the arms are both broken and the head's all bandaged. And he walks over and the first thing he says to the person, "Does this mean you're not going to be teaching Sunday school tomorrow?" How do you treat people that you're trying to lead or guide in some way? You know, it seems that it's sometimes those who are given just a little bit of authority who want to abuse that. Or those who are new in a position of leadership who want to abuse that authority that they have. During World War I, General Pershing went out one night and got into the trenches with the men and forgot where he was and lit his cigarette. And the sergeant just down there snapped at him and he said, "Put out that light!" And when he realized it was General Pershing he was speaking to, he apologized profusely. And Pershing said, "That's all right, son. Just be glad I wasn't a lieutenant." You know, Jesus was given all authority. And yet he got down on his knees with a towel wrapped around him, and he proceeded to wash the feet of each one of his apostles. But to me, the most amazing thing about that passage recorded in John 13 is what it says about Jesus just before he gets down and washes their feet. It says that Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power and that he had come from God and was returning to God. Jesus knew that he had all power. He knew that he was God. He knew where he came from. He knew where he was going. He knew he was going to be glorified again. And knowing all of that, boy, that would just puff any normal person's head up to 10 times its normal size. But Jesus, knowing all of that, got down on his knees and didn't use that authority selfishly, but used it to serve others. That's why he said what he said in Matthew 20, verse 28, when he said, "The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." How do you treat the people who are under you, the people who serve you, the people who do your bidding? Rate yourself in this area. Not only here at church, how do you treat the girl in the checkout line in the grocery store? How do you treat the person that waits on you in the restaurant? By your actions and your attitudes, you're having an influence on people, either for or against the one you serve. Question number 3, do you openly express affirmation in your relationships? Look what Paul says here in chapter 2. He says, "So I made up my mind that I would not make another painful visit to you. For if I grieve you, who's left to make me glad? but you whom I've grieved. I wrote as I did so that when I came, I should not be distressed by those who ought to make me rejoice. I had confidence in all of you that you would all share my joy. What would it make us feel like here at this church if we had an apostle of the Lord who came and spoke here at sunset? And what if the Apostle Paul could stand here, and what if he could look out on this audience, and if he could say to us the same thing he said to the Corinthian church, I have confidence in every one of you. I think I'd sit up a little straighter in my pew if the Apostle Paul said that to me. I have confidence in every one of you that you'll do the right thing. Did you know that people generally live up to your expectations of them? Paul believed the best about them, and he trusted them to do the right thing. You know, if you don't trust people, they'll usually show themselves untrustworthy. But if you believe in people, they tend to live up to those expectations. Some expert wrote that it takes 40 compliments to offset one disparaging remark. I occasionally will receive a nice note or an email, or someone will say something very kind to me, more than just the obligatory good sermon that I sometimes receive as people exit the auditorium. And I tell you, I have been preaching for almost 40 years now. And when I receive a genuine note of encouragement, a word of encouragement, it absolutely makes my day. I never get tired of that. I'm like Barney Fife after a good arrest, just strutting around my office when I get an encouraging note like that from some of you. Believing in someone can change their life. It can make all the difference in the world. I wish we knew the end of the story. Someday when we're in heaven, we'll find out the end of that story of that woman caught in adultery, the way Jesus dealt with her so sensitively. He bent down and wrote on the ground and took the attention off of her there in her embarrassment and her shame before all those religious leaders who had caught her in the act of adultery. And Jesus then asked that question that sent them all home. Let him who's without sin cast the first stone. Which one of you is without sin? They dropped those stones and walked away. And then he said to her, where are they? Who are they that condemn you? And she says, there's no one's here that condemns me. And he said, neither do I. Now go and sin no more. And I would like to believe that in saying that and treating her that way, and throwing that high challenge out before her to go and leave that life of sin, that she took Jesus at his word, that she was ennobled by his forgiveness, and that she lived a life that was very different from the life that she had been living. You know, that's what affirmation does when we forgive freely. In our first service this morning, Clifton Jewell came down, and you need to know this so you can pray for him. Clifton has such a tender, sensitive heart. And he came down here and he said, I did something that I shouldn't have done. And he was in tears. He said, when we had that white elephant exchange program for all the jet setters, he said, I told a bald-faced lie. And I said, well, Clifton, what should I say? And he said, just tell them what I did. I told a bald-faced lie. And he said, I don't know why I did it, and I'm sorry I did it, and I know we shouldn't lie to each other, but I did it. And so I shared that at first service. Harold Hadley prayed for him that God would forgive him of that, and that those he had lied to would forgive him of that. And we assured him of our love and our acceptance, and we hugged him. And I tell you, when we treat people and affirm people, even when they make mistakes, it changes them and it helps them to live on a higher plane and to want to do better from then on. Paul wrote in Ephesians 4:29, do not let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouths, but only what is helpful for building others up according to their needs, that it may benefit those who listen. How are you at giving verbal bouquets? How good are you at building people up and affirming them and complimenting them and letting them know when you appreciate the things that they do that are good, or when you encourage them when they don't always do things that are good. And lastly, the question I want to ask, do you tell those who need to hear it, I love you? In verse 4 of chapter 2, Paul talks about his weeping over this church and the things that he had written. He said, "For I wrote you out of great distress and anguish of heart and with many tears, not to grieve you, but to let you know the depth of my love for you." Well, Paul loved them so dearly. And he cried when he wrote to them because he loved them so dearly. And I've had any number of folks here in this church family come up and tell me when I preached a lesson on love or something, they've said, "You know, my parents or my father or my mother never was able to tell me that they loved me. I never heard those words from their mouth." And they've also said, "You know, I knew they loved me because they took care of me and they taught me right from wrong, but I never ever heard them tell me that they loved me. And I would have loved to have heard those words." And if you're in that category this morning, I want to just challenge you to break that chain. Because it's more than likely that if your father never told you that he loved you, it was because his father before him never said it to him. And that kind of thing tends to just be passed on down inadvertently, generation after generation after generation. So if you've never been told that you been loved by a parent, don't you let your child go through life and never hear it from you. Break the chain and tell them that you love them, as hard as it is to do that, so that they will have the courage to say that to their children, and then all future generations can hear a different message, a message that we all desperately need to hear. I have the last letter that my dad ever wrote to me. We didn't, either one of us, know that that would be the last letter, but back in 1996, he wrote me, a short time later, he died, and so I took that letter and I put it in my file, and I've saved that letter, and I am so grateful for what he said to me in that letter. He said two things that mean the world to me. He said, as he closed, "Son, I love you, and I'm proud of you." Now, I don't always do it, but I almost always do it when I talk to any of my girls on the telephone or when I send them an email. I try to say the same thing to them. I love you and I'm proud of you, because one day they'll hear from me for the last time, and I want that to be the thing they remember from me. Paul said there's faith and there's hope and there's love, but the greatest is love. And how can we hope to influence this wicked world for Jesus if we are not loving people? The greatest compliment I ever hear a family say about one who's deceased, if I'm preaching a funeral, when they say, "He or she was such a loving person." Boy, I hope that that's what's said about me. There's no greater compliment than to be known as a loving person. Jesus said, "As the Father has loved me, so I love you." And then he went on to say, "As I have loved you, so you love one another." Well, we need to tell each other much more often than we do that we love each other. Can you say those three little words, "I love you"? Do you say those words? Well, rate yourself. Give yourself a letter grade here on this sensitivity test. Are you perceptive to other people's feelings? How do you treat people that are your subordinates? Are you an affirming person that builds others up? And do you tell people that you love them? You know, the good news is that through the power that we have in Jesus Christ, we can change. You're never too old to change. You can start doing right at any time in life, and you can make improvements at any stage. If you need to make those improvements, I hope you will. We have the most loving God for our Father. And He's told us over and over again that He loves us, and He has demonstrated over and over again, nowhere greater than at the cross, that He loves us. And He wants us to be with Him forever. He wants to shower us with love for all of eternity. If you need to respond to His gracious invitation, we hope you'll do that this morning. If you need prayer, this church, I can promise you, will demonstrate their love for you before you leave and go home by praying for you and by affirming you and hugging you, and you'll go away knowing that you're loved. If you need to respond for prayer, we invite you to do that too. If you need to come, won't you come while we stand and sing?